So welcome to the IBMC and the book report today. It's going to all be about Dharma and history. I told Nam that I wrote a book, and Nam says, "What kind of book did you write?" I said, "Well, about what I used to do." He said, "Oh, it's a history book." So this is the book. It was published last month. It's called Urban Dharma, 20 Years of Buddhist Stories from an L.A. City Monk. So it's very much a Western perspective of doing Buddhism rather than being Buddhism. Now, Rebecca is the co-author, and Rebecca used to live here, and that's how the book got started. So about 9 years ago, she was between jobs, and she had sublet her apartment, and she had been coming to Wednesday night meditation, and she needed a place to stay. So she asked if we had any openings at that time, and I said, "Yes, we have an opening in Kuan Yin House, a little room that's available." And she said, "Okay, let me talk to Doug, residential manager." And she arranged to move in, and she was here for 2 months. She didn't have a bed or a chair or a desk. She had a yoga mat and a suitcase. And that's how she lived here for 2 months. Now, we were talking, and she wasn't impressed with me at all. She'd been coming to Wednesday night meditation and listening to my talks and stuff, and she says, "You know, this white guy Buddhism, I don't know. It's missing something." And I said, yeah. And then we started talking about my community service. And she said, "That sounds good. Maybe we could do a book about that." And I said, "Really?" She said, "Yeah, community service is important." I said, "Okay." So for like 3-4 weeks, we sat on the porch of Kuan Yin, and then we had a table and a couple chairs set up, and she had her coffee and her tape recorder. It was probably an audio recorder rather than a tape recorder. And she would drink her coffee, and she'd ask me questions. And I'd give her some answers, and then she asked some more questions. And I'd give her some answers, and then we just started talking about the stories of being in community service in Los Angeles and what I was involved in and what I experienced and how I looked at it. And so after a couple months, she said, I think this will work. I think this might be a good book." But then she got a phone call. She says, "Kusala, I got to leave. I'm sorry, but I got to leave. I just got a call from New York that the Bett House, Robert Thurman, and I'm going to be working for him organizing their digital media. So we'll continue the book at another time." I said, "Okay." And so she moved to New York, and she started working for Robert Thurman and digitizing everything. And then her contract was over, and she contacted me and said, "You know, I'm out of my contract now, and I got some time. Let's continue. We'll do Zoom. And we'll Zoom back and forth, and we'll talk about the book, and we'll read each other parts of the book to see how it sounds and how it reads, and then we can go from there." So we're on Zoom, and we're talking to each other, and we're reading the book to each other, and then she says, "Kusala, I got to go again. I just got a chance to be a producer for TED Talks, and I'm going to take that. So we'll put the book on the back burner, and I'll talk to you later." So we had a year or two of silence, you know, and then she's out of TED. So she's, "Kusala, the contract's over. Got some time now." This is like 8 years now. And she says, "Let's get this thing done. I'm getting tired of holding on to it. I got to give it birth. I got to get rid of it. I got to abandon it. I got stuff to do with my life." I said, "Okay." So now we went from Zoom to the phone and Zoom, and we would call each other, and we would talk to each other, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then she says, "You know what? I think it's ready." I said, "Great, okay. I'm going to find a publisher," she says. Okay. So she submitted the manuscript to a variety of publishers, and they all said no. Now, I wasn't bummed out about that, because Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance was submitted over 20 times before somebody finally found the value of that book, which became, you know, iconic. So I figured, well, it's just the amount of time. And she said this. She says, we're going to self-publish. And I'm going to create a publishing company. And I'm going to call it Black Boat Media. And we'll set up a bank account, and we'll have an LLC, and we'll put your book on Amazon and Barnes & Nobles. And I said, why Barnes & Nobles? She said, because a lot of people don't like Amazon because it's the big one. And they'd rather give their money rather than to Jeff Bezos to somebody else. So I said, okay. So we got the... Then she said, we're going to have a Kindle and we're going to have a Nook, which is the ebook on Barnes & Nobles. So we've got the Kindle, we got the book, we got the Nook, we got the book. We're all set to go. So I said, okay, when's it going to be released? When are people going to be able to get the book? She said, in April, in honor of your birthday. And I've chosen 4/24/24. And I'm thinking to myself, are you studying astrology now? What? She just liked the way that sounded, 4/24/24. So on 4/24/24, we made the book available. And if you follow me on Facebook, you know we made the book available. Okay, so how's it going? You know what? It's going pretty good. I got our first 5-star comment from the UK, listening to my podcast for a long time, and they really like the book. And I'm thinking, the UK, we're going global. You know, it may just be one book, but we got one book in the UK. And my Facebook friend in Sweden went to her Amazon resource, and they have it in Sweden too. So she's going to buy her copy in Sweden. So it continues. We've got a lot of 5-star reviews. We've got 2 2-star reviews. But I'm thinking they didn't read the book. They're just 2-star people. That's all. So what's the book about? Well, it's about my community service. And how did it all start? Why was I chosen to involve myself in community service? Well, I gave a talk at Cal State Pomona to the Buddhist Club. And the Buddhist Club was sponsored by Shilai Temple. And I gave my talk, and we had a photographer and a writer from the Los Angeles Times. So they took a couple pictures, and they wrote a little story, and I was in the LA Times. Cool. Yes, I felt the same way. Yes. Then somebody read the article. Go figure. And it was Deacon Szymanski, and he was at California State Prison for Men in Lancaster, California. So he said, I read your article. I said, thank you. He said, we have some Buddhist prisoners up there. I said, you have got Buddhist prisoners? I didn't think they went to prison. But they do. And I don't really know what to say. I'm the Catholic guy. Would you be willing to come up to Lancaster and give a talk to the Buddhist prisoners? And I said, sure, I'd be glad to. Now, at that time, I didn't have a car. I only had a motorcycle. And it's upper desert. And it's always windy. And it's colder than cold during the winter and hotter than hot during the summer. And it was quite a ride every time I went up there. And then you can't take anything into the prison. So I had to sort of like put stuff on my motorcycle in the parking lot of the prison. And I asked them, is it safe just to leave all this stuff on my motorcycle? He said, sure. He didn't say it with a lot of feeling, though. He just said, sure, you know, nobody's going to steal your stuff at a prison, are they? So I went in and met the prisoners. And they were really nice guys. you know, they did one or two things that weren't so good, and that's why they're there. But the rest of the time, they seemed pretty normal. And we talked, and I never asked them what they did to get there. And we had a couple Asian Buddhists born in an Asian country. Buddhism was their primary religion. And what I found interesting about that is they didn't know much about Buddhism because they would offer incense and do prayers to the Buddha. But as far as the theology behind Buddhism and stuff, didn't interest them. And then we had some people that practiced yoga in the prison, and we had some people that just wanted to do something, so they showed up. So we had our little group. Now, this is in the chapel on the prison, and we had the Muslims over there, and the Christians over there, and the Buddhists over here. So we all had our little groups. And we would talk, and da-da-da. And so I was there for a year. And I can remember starting the meditation. I said, okay, now bring your blankets from your cell, and we can sit on the blankets, and you can meditate. And so they did, but not one of them closed their eyes. They're always looking to the left, to the right. They didn't trust anybody. But it's prison, so I can understand that. Then they said, hey, you know, it really stinks in prison. Can you bring us some incense? We would like to have some incense. That would smell so good. I said, sure. So I went around to a couple temples and I got some incense. I mean, hundreds of sticks, you know. And I gave them to the guys. And the next time I went there, they said, hey, can you get us some more incense? We're all out. I said, but I brought you hundreds of sticks of incense. How can you be all out? They said, we sold it. I was the supplier. So I said, no more incense. Okay. But I brought him some books, and I brought him some audio cassettes. And then they said to me, the books are gone, and the audio cassettes have been taped over, and there's some guy with a guitar singing Kumbaya. And I said, really? So we all sort of went out to where the books were in the bookshelf in the chapel, and they were all gone. I said, okay, somebody doesn't like the Buddhist stuff here. So I said, who wants to volunteer to keep the Buddhist books in their cell? And you can be the librarian. And then they can come to you and get the book and then bring the book back to you, and we don't have to worry about them missing. They all assumed that it was the Christians that did it. And they were sort of getting antsy about maybe we can have like a face-off with them and a dialogue with them. And I'm thinking, no, we don't want that. No, no, no. We'll just get some more books. That's all. We got plenty of books. Okay. So I was up there for a year. And then I got a phone call. Mr. Noy Russell. This was downtown Los Angeles Juvenile Hall, East Lake Division. He said, I saw your article in the newspaper. Would you be willing to come to the juvenile hall and talk to the kids about Buddhism? I said, do you have any Buddhists there? He said, not that I know of, but I think they'd find what you had to say interesting. I said, okay. So I made an appointment to go down and talk to them. I was there for 5 years, it turns out, but I went down to talk to them, and I went to the high-risk offenders unit. That was the first unit I spoke at. And I walked in, and I felt immediately comfortable because we all had the same haircut. I said, cool, man. And then I said, is anybody here suffering? And every hand went up. I said, okay, well, let me tell you what the Buddha said about suffering, and more importantly, about the end of suffering. So I was able to go on a weekly or biweekly basis to juvenile hall, and I found some Dharma teachers in the area. And I asked them if they'd join me so we could sort of spread out to the juvenile hall and have meditation and Dharma talks, and they could ask questions. So we had like maybe 10, 15 people going to juvenile hall from the Buddhist perspective, talking about suffering and the end of suffering. And we were able to give talks in the classrooms too, because when you go to juvenile hall, you have to go to school. See, you never get out of going to school. So they were in school, and I gave some talks in the classroom, and I can remember this little old lady. She was the teacher, and I walked in, and had my robes on, and you know, and she looked at me and she said, "You know, you can't talk about God in the classroom." And I said, "No problem." She was very impressed by that. Then there was a Catholic volunteer. There's a lot of Catholic volunteers at Juvenile Hall. And so he asked me, we were passing each other on a walkway, and he said, "Are you the Buddhist?" I said, yeah. He said, "Are there any Buddhists here?" I said, "You know, I haven't met any yet." And then he says, "Well, why are you here?" I said, "Because they're suffering." And he said, "Me too." So that was a wonderful exchange in just a minute or two of setting the stage for why we're all there. Now, at Juvenile Hall, they have a lot of volunteers. They have professional volunteers. They have writers and filmmakers and lawyers and doctors. And what they're doing is they're going to Juvenile Hall to give these kids an idea of the opportunities they would have in their life if they went to school, if they got different people to hang out with, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, this is wonderful. That didn't happen in prison. But Juvenile Hall, they really want these guys and gals to be better and be something in their life. Now, I got a call from Camp Kilpatrick, which is a probation camp. And the woman who was running the place went to Tupten Dargi Ling, which is a Tibetan center in Long Beach. And she would go there, and she was a layperson, and that was her Buddhist center. And she said, "I heard about you. Would you be willing to come up to Camp Kilpatrick and talk to the guys?" I said, "Yeah, sure." And I found out this is an athletic camp, and they basically play football and other sports, and they have a really good football team. Yeah. There you go. So I went up there, and she said to me, "What would you like to do?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. What do you think?" She said, "I heard you play harmonica." I said, "Yeah. Why don't you have a harmonica class?" I said, "Well, you know, I'm not musically trained. I just do it by ear, and I read a couple books, and da, 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 da." She said, "That's fine. These kids aren't musically trained either, so they won't know the difference." I said, "Okay." So I contacted a friend named Jeff Gold, who's in the music business, and he contacted John Popper, who was part of a musical group, and I got some harmonicas donated. And so I took them up to Camp Kilpatrick. We had the guys there and stuff, and I gave them each their harmonica. I said, "You get to keep this, and when you go home, you can show your parents what you got at camp. You know, I'm sure that really will impress your parents, you know." But I needed to get somebody else. So I found a guy named John McDuffie, who actually was a guitar player and studied and knew what he was doing, and he volunteered to come up with me. So now I had my guitar player, who actually knew something about music, and I had me, who didn't know anything about music but played the harmonica, and we taught the kids how to play harmonica. And it was a lot of fun because they learned the blues, and what better place to play the blues than in a probation camp? Because everybody's got the blues up there. So I was with them for, I think 4 or 5 years. Yeah, 5 years. And then I was invited to go to Garden Grove. And Garden Grove, I had never really heard of very much, but the mayor said, "I saw your article in the paper." I said, "Whoa, okay. We'd like you to come down and be the keynote speaker at the mayor's prayer breakfast. Happens every year." And I said to him, "Well, you know, I really don't pray, but I like breakfast." He said, "That's good enough." So I went to Garden Grove, and I was able to be part of the chaplains program. They wanted to have a diverse chaplains program. They wanted to have all the major religions represented as police chaplains. And so they said, "Would you be willing to be a police chaplain? You know, you have to, once a month, you have to do a ride-along with the officer. And then once a month, you have to have dinner," sounds good to me, and talk about your experiences, and all the chaplains get together, and they talk back and forth. I said, "Okay." So they said, "Okay, the first thing you need to do is you need to get your bulletproof vest." I said, really? He said, yeah, yeah, right. And so they arranged for me to go down and get fitted for my bulletproof vest. And the woman's really nice, you know. She said, okay, now, is it comfortable? What size do you wear? Okay, now, pretend you have a gun and you're holding it out in front of you. Do you feel okay holding out that gun in the bulletproof vest? I said, yeah, it feels good. We, you know, we're not allowed to have guns, though, as a chaplain. Doesn't matter. We need that. Yeah, sorry. Okay. So I went around for 7 years as a police chaplain once a month in Garden Grove. And the thing about it, which was uncomfortable for the police officers, is they didn't know I was going to be riding with them that day. I would call up and say, I want to ride like on Thursday from 12 to 12. So 12 in the afternoon, 12 at night. And they said, okay, come on down. So I would go there. And then they'd say, okay, we're going to assign you to car number 42. And this is Sergeant Joe Friday. And I said, okay, sounds good. So he sees me and he says, who are you? I said, I'm the chaplain. I get to ride with you today. And he takes all his stuff out of the front seat, puts it in the trunk, you know, okay, you can sit here, you know. And, okay, so then he never met me. I never met him. I'm sitting next to him for 12 hours in the car. So what do you talk about? Well, his wife just got some new drapes. Oh, okay. What color are they? I said, you know, and that kind of thing. So we'd do that. And then we'd always get around to Buddhism. And then we get around to, how do you feel about God? You know, because they didn't have any Buddhist police officers that I could figure out. That they had Christians. I said, well, you know, a lot of Buddhists believe in God. I said, you know, yeah, okay. Which is true. There are a lot of Buddhists who believe in God, but not because of Buddhism. You know, and so we would, you know, I would sort of like do that. I would sort of like give them a little bit of this, a little bit of that about Buddhism. Not too much, because I didn't want to scare them. And then you know, he would talk about stuff and I'd talk about stuff and then we would go eat, you know. Now, that was really a strange event to eat as a police officer because oftentimes they would say to me, you know, we can't really eat in public because people will think that we're not doing our job, even though we do get lunch, but they'll think. So they had keys to different businesses that they could go into the business. They could use the bathroom. They could eat lunch or dinner in the business if it was closed. And one time we ate in a bank. The officer had a key to the bank. And I went over to look at the big safe. It was like this giant door, you know, and it had the wheel and the thing. And the officer looked at me looking at the safe and said, don't touch anything. Not going to touch anything, you know. So, and it worked out well because they had, you know, the businesses had more security because the police officers would visit the businesses and the officers had some place to eat and be out of the public eye. When we did eat, like at Subway or something, they sat and watched it being made because there are a lot of people who don't like police officers and they'll do things to the food. So they like to watch the food being made. And then when we sat down, the officer always had his back to the wall and his face to the door. He wanted to see who was coming in and going out. And I said, okay. So there was a certain sense of, you know, survival that's kicked in when they did anything. And I can remember one night, it was New Year's Eve, and we had the fireworks going on. So we parked underneath a bridge in Garden Grove. Because not only were the fireworks going on, but the guns were going off. And he said, you know, those bullets go up, but they have to come down. I said, yeah, I agree. So we sat underneath the bridge for a couple hours and talked about stuff. And it was really an interesting experience. I'm glad I did it. And it was able to see how committed these men and women are to enforcing the law and doing it in a good way, not an overly aggressive way, but doing it in a good, sensitive way. So while all this was going on in my community service, and each chapter has a chapter on the police department and the police and juvenile hall and the camp and that kind of stuff, I was at UCLA. So P. Ananda, who's Dharma Vijaya Buddhist Vihara, he's the abbot there, there was a woman named Heidi Singh. And Heidi Singh was a chaplain on the UCLA campus. But she kept getting more and more things to do, and she was married, and she had a kid, and so she said, I can't do it anymore. So P. Ananda said, Kusala, would you like to be at UCLA as a chaplain? I said, yeah, that would be good. So I ended up being at UCLA for like 12 years. And I started off with the University Religious Conference at UCLA. And I was the on-campus Buddhist chaplain. And then we started a Buddhist club. And it was non-denominational, so any kind of Buddhism could be practiced. At the, before it was the, before that, the club was pretty much Chinese Buddhism, Shilai Temple. Okay, but now non-denominational, so we had yoga people, we had Buddhists from all denominations, and give Dharma talks in the Catholic Center. The Catholics invited us to use their center and give me a parking space. Now, if you've ever been to UCLA, parking spaces are worth $10,000. So to have a parking place and a place to speak the Dharma is perfect. And of course, the Catholic Center, too, was a, sort of a religious, you could feel the tone, you could feel the energy. It was good. And then I was asked by the medical center at UCLA, would you be willing to give talks to the new chaplains on Buddhist patient care and end-of-life issues? And I said, sure. You know. So I gave my first talk. I had to do a little research, you know, to find out how Buddhists died differently than Christians and Muslims and Jews. And that went on for a really long time. And that was exciting. That was fun. You know, because it was like they're all chaplains. Most of these chaplains, though, were making money. You know, I was always free. That's why I was invited to participate. How much do you charge, Kusala? I'm free. Welcome in. You know, and so it was good. And there are classes you can take to get certified as a hospital chaplain. And so you can make a living doing it. You know, you don't have to be a monk or a nun. You can make a living doing it and be helpful, because there's a lot of people that end up in hospitals who are Buddhist. You know, and it's just like, I can remember I had a cat bite on my finger and had to spend a couple days at Kaiser Permanente down on Sunset Boulevard. And I thought I'd test it out. I said, do you have any Buddhist chaplains here? They said, oh yeah, we do. I get them for you. Okay, thanks. And she comes back and says, no, we don't have any Buddhist chaplains here. I said, okay, well, thanks anyway. So it's something that is necessary, and it's happening slowly but surely in all these institutions. You know, that the Buddhists are coming in and the Buddhists are giving another perspective. But what they're doing too is they're integrating Western culture into the Buddhist perspective. They're making Buddhism available to people who live in Los Angeles who don't know anything about Buddhism. So you're not going to be able to really get deep into its theology or what it means and da da this and da da da. You're going to, how can you use it? How can you use it? And I think that's what Rebecca had in mind when she said, we need to do this book, because this book is not about being a Buddhist. This book is about doing Buddhism. So how do you do Buddhism? And that's what every page is about. How do you do Buddhism? Well, number one, you do it with kindness. Number one. And in all these different situations you find yourself in, kindness is important. At the prison, at the juvenile hall, in the hospitals. Kindness is important. You know, and how do you keep that perspective when the world is in chaos or the situation you find yourself in is chaotic? How do you find those roots? How do you find that reference point? And that's the deal. That's what our practice leads us to. You know, so we have a lot of people that like to be call themselves Buddhists, which is fine. I like being called a Buddhist. And I came to Buddhism because I wanted to learn about Buddhism and how to be a Buddhist. I wanted to be a Buddhist. Okay. So you do your thing, and I got ordained, and I'm being a Buddhist, and I'm being a Buddhist, and I'm being a Buddhist. But then what's the next step? And in Zen, they have something about the guy goes on retreat in this cave for 10 years, and he gets enlightened, and he says, I'm there, I'm finally there. And he walks out of the cave and walks down the hill into the city, and somebody bumps into him, And he gets mad. And I'm thinking, see, 10 years, man, you know. That's not doing Buddhism, you know. And so it's interesting. And then I was at a Western monastic conference, and we had this couple. And they were going to give a presentation to the whole conference. We had men and women from different Buddhist traditions, and we were really eager to hear because they had spent a year on retreat in silence, secluded. They'd have their food brought to them, and they'd go to get their food. And they didn't talk to each other either. They didn't talk. They just silence and away from everything for a whole year. So I'm thinking, this is going to be so cool to hear what they had to say. And there they showed up, and they looked like hippies from the 70s, you know, and they were really cool-looking people, and they sat down, and they started to talk. They couldn't talk. They had nothing to say. What do you say about a year-long silent retreat? Well, it was pretty quiet. You know, I'm going, yeah. So retreats are important. It's good to do that. It's good to check in with yourself. That's what retreat actually does. Let's see, check in with yourself and see how it's going and stuff. But it doesn't really lead to much else than suffering, you know, suffering and silence. So, okay. So now you can see the suffering with clear eyes, and you can see how it works. And you can see how words keep interfering with your direct experience of the world, that you're seeing concepts instead of a tree. You're seeing the concept of a tree and stuff like that. And that's good. Okay. So now you get all that out of the way. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do? How are you going to practice your kindness today? So every day, I think every Buddhist should practice one kindness. Whatever that is. Open the door for somebody. You know? Just for no reason. Just say, oh, here. Let me get that for you. Or you're standing in line at Vons, you know? Okay. Here, you only got one item? You can go in front. I've got 10 items. It's okay. You know, one kindness a day. That's doing Buddhism. You know? Kindness and compassion. Now, I make a distinction between kindness and compassion. So, kindness for me is the intention. The intention to do kindness. The actual act of kindness I call compassion. So compassion is the activity of kindness. So can you turn your intention into an action? Can you make the world just a little bit better every day because you're doing one kindness a day? And I think it's possible. And I'm lucky because we have a couple cats that hang out here, and I get to feed them every day. So I know for sure I will at least do one kindness a day. And the cats will not let me forget. So if you have a stray in your neighborhood, looks a little hungry and ragged, you know, get a little coffee filter, get some kibble in there, give an offering. Here, you know. See, anything, you know. It doesn't have to be big. You don't have to change the world. You just have to change the moment. Available on Amazon and Barnes & Nobles. I'm going to stop there and ask if anybody has any comments or questions about what I said or didn't say.